Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwane aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande.
To Hell with Science,
episode 128.
Anyways, I think we're drifting off topic a bit. Returning to the main point, I suggested that if you were mounting a serious assault to conquer the Keltham environment and you hadn't figured out yet how to get any result, but yes, your next step should include measuring other things about me besides my yes answer. Measuring how much time I took to answer each input as precisely as you could with your time-measuring instruments and writing down all those results. Trying to predict the time for new inputs you constructed. I don't know how much probability you got off Asmodia, but can any of the researcher candidates say what that advice truly means? Why it makes sense? In terms of the law of probability?
Because it removes twos. It destroys some of the probabilities by exposing them to reality. It alters the ratio of the masses on each of the thousand sides of the scale by evaporating the weight on them unevenly between them. The more we see that some types of questions seem to take longer for you to answer, the less likely it is that the time it takes you to answer a question is unrelated to the contents of the question.
Every time you expose yourself to the reality of my yes answer, if you weren't absolutely sure already that you'd get a yes answer, some of the probabilities evaporate. That's already true. What's different about adding the timing measurement then? How does the evaporation of probability change with measuring my timing? How does it change with measuring my timing more precisely? How does it change with trying to predict the timing for particular inputs instead of trying random inputs and passively observing the timed results?
After receiving mental approval, Willa says, I was really surprised by the first long pause after an input of very simple small numbers. Then I tried bigger numbers and got a short pause. Then I tried small numbers again and got another long pause. This seemed to sharply reduce the probability that whatever was being done to the numbers was a direct computation of some kind. And from there, I realized the type of answers I'd been missing really fast.
The leading theories I had were that long pauses meant difficult questions. Long pauses were unrelated to the difficulty of the question, perhaps being randomly decided. And long pauses were a deliberate attempt to mislead me. Trolling, in your parlance, in that order. I would have put roughly a 6-2-1 ratio on them when I started, though in fact I did not think that explicitly. If I asked a question that I expected would be difficult and you answered slowly, that was evidence that either I was right it was difficult or you were trolling me, and also that, given that I believed it was a difficult question, that my first theory was right and my second and third theories were wrong. If, on the other hand, I expected that it would be difficult, and you answered quickly. That was evidence either that I was wrong about it being difficult, or I was right and you were trolling me. And also that my leading theory was wrong, and hence one of the others, or neither of the others, was correct.
So that's the particular things that happened during your timing side channel experiments, and what you thought about them in Tal'Dane. The thing I'm asking for is more like, well, I called it probability sight at one point. By analogy to arcane sight, and Asmodia called it that too, after she suddenly developed it one day. It's an abstract way of seeing things that would generalize to doing more science later. I'm trying to figure if there's some way to get it into people without either raising them as Dathilani, or dropping an artifact headband on them for 2 hours and inducing a permanent need for a cognitive prosthetic. Let me try. So, a few days ago, when I was introducing the idea of lost powers of two as the truth-functional relationship between a probability claim and reality, Carissa was briefly worried about how, if you could only ever lose 2S by playing that game, would that mean people would be incentivized to avoid playing it? And I was like, nothing bad directly happens to you when you lose a 2. It's just a relative measure of how well you're predicting, given that you're trying to predict at all. When you start trying to predict the timing, you lose more 2s or bits in baseline. The joint probability you assign to everything you see goes down because you see more. But in the course of losing more 2s, you further narrow down what's probably true and concentrate the remaining probability that hasn't been eliminated. This is not necessarily something that happens every time you manage to predict more and lose more bits. If that was always a productive activity, I could go on spinning a coin and seeing whether it came up showing the queen's face, or the text on the reverse side, and lose one bit every time. The thing about the timing side channel is that some different hypotheses about what could be going on lose different amounts of 2s. That's what makes it an informative experiment. That's why adding this new variable to measure and predict, which makes you lose more 2s, is actually a great move, because the 2s are differentially coming from different hypotheses. Figuring out which hypothesis is true is what we care about, not how many 2s we lose along the way. Inside predictions, we didn't stake lots of value on getting right. Why does it help to measure the times more precisely?
Because it's more specific.
Can you be more meta-specific about exactly why it helps to be more specific in the language of probability?
Because the more precise your claim is, the fewer 2s you lose if you get it right, and the more 2s you lose if you get it wrong.
I was asking about why it helps to have a more precise measurement, not to make more precise claims. But maybe you're right, and all we really need is the precise claim. So we should measure my response times to within the nearest 6 seconds, but predict that my next response will take exactly 4.59823987 seconds. This way we get all the benefits of a precise claim, but without the risk of losing lots of 2s by actually measuring. Would you agree that this is the pathway of wisdom? If not, why not?
More precise answers rule out more things. Like if we're looking for a person, and we can measure where he is but only to within 500 miles of precision, our measurement moves us towards all the theories that said he'd be in Cheliax, but can't tell the difference between theories that said he'd be in Igorian and theories that said he'd be in Ostenso.
You're not actually gaining more information from the precise claim if you can't measure whether it was truer than a less precise claim.
This time it would have helped because if you kept taking data, it would have been clear the pauses were slowly growing longer, on average, as more and more sequences were tried. After long enough, any explanation that didn't have a reason for the pauses to grow longer wouldn't predict that, and it would lose 2s.
Because short or long is yes or no, but fractions of a second are continuous. You can only get one bit out of a yes or no question, but many more out of a continuous one. The more data you have, the greater the updates you can make based on it.
Having lots of precision can't possibly help. I mean, the difference between 4.59823987 seconds and 4.59823986 seconds, that difference isn't going to be related to anything.
I mean, it totally can help by the time your civilization, but you're not going to get there for a while. That's the kind of precise difference you'd run into if you were measuring the difference in exactly how fast time flows at the bottom of a mountain versus the top of a mountain. And okay, let me finish responding to some of the previous things. You can't literally measure a continuous quantity and get a continuous answer, in fact, because that would correspond to infinite precision and an infinite number of bits in the measurement. It's also not true that you can only lose at most one bit on predicting something yes or no. For instance, you could predict yes with probability 63/64 and no at 1/64 and see no and lose 6 bits. When it comes to noticing just that the pauses are getting longer and longer, just measuring to the nearest round works for that. You don't need to measure to the nearest second. Being able to notice the pauses are getting longer is an argument for measuring the timing at all, because it causes some hypotheses to differentially lose 2s. It's not an argument for measuring precisely. Among the remaining arguments we have, an argument that precise claims help by allowing right claims to lose fewer 2s, and wrong claims to lose more, an argument that, if you don't measure precisely, you can't verify or falsify precise claims, an argument about how precise measurements can rule out more theories, because if you can see closer than 500 miles, you can distinguish between claims about Igorian and claims about Ostenso. Those arguments are all valid, for having been spoken in Tal'Dane, but can anyone rephrase it more into the language of the law of probability, to fit it all into a common framework? Tier 2s may now also answer.
A more precise claim is one that describes a smaller set of worlds, says Gregoria. Not all the worlds where the person is in Cheliax, just the ones where they're in Ostenso, or just the ones where they're in this fortress. more precise claims are going to take more 2s to kind, find, and more observations are going to be evidence about a more precise claim. Almost nothing I see is evidence about whether Asmodeus is great, because what does that even mean? But lots of things I see are evidence about whether Asmodeus expends more resources on the material than other gods, and still more things I see are evidence. No, that's not precisely it. Asmodeus has 13 tines in his crown is a precise claim, but almost nothing has bearing on it. Okay, I think there is something there, I just need to nail it down. More precise claims point at smaller pieces of reality. It takes more twos to point to smaller pieces of reality. A theory that makes a more precise prediction is much more valuable. If it's right, it hit a smaller target. A theory that makes a more precise prediction is more easily wrong, which is just another way of saying what I just said. It couldn't be more valuable if it was right, unless it was more easily wrong. You have to have a much better understanding of reality to make more precise predictions, and have them still be correct. And your claim is only as precise as, if my measurement can't tell the difference between two claims, then I don't get any of the benefits of having made one rather than the other. A claim is only usefully precise if it's precise about what you're going to see, so what your measurement is.
I think possibly he's just looking for us to rephrase in terms of problem 5 from that list of 7 problems he gave us just before the artifact headband got dropped on Asmodea, which, if I remember right, was like, if you divide claims into 1,000 parts and predict it down to the 1,000th, that's like predicting that exact thing 10 times as strongly than if you only say it's in 1/100th. But it could be in any of 10,000ths inside that, and you're not saying which. If you only measure it down to the 1/100th, you'd... I'm not sure what happens then, but you obviously can't be proven correct in the claim about 1,000ths.
Yes, that's what I just said, Gregoria says.
Yes. That is exactly what Alexandra was trying to say.
Tier 1S.
It doesn't take more 2S to point at smaller pieces of reality. It takes more 2S to point at smaller pieces of the probability distribution. If you assign probability 1/64 to something, it takes you 6 bits to point there. If you're already assigning 98/100 to some particular measurement coming in at exactly 0.891 seconds, you're only going to lose 0.032s each time. Once you can exactly predict the measurements very certainly, they're not helping you narrow down things much further. It would only automatically take more bits to specify narrower pieces of reality if there was some kind of fixed probability distribution, or this actually feels like it's pointing somewhere important, but I don't know where yet. Precise claims don't have to talk about a smaller set of worlds. There can still be probability everywhere. It's that most of the probability will be concentrated in a narrower set of worlds. But theories only have so much probability to spread over all the possible precise measurements, so when there's more possible measurements, the probabilities on the vast majority of possible measurements have to be thinner. Measuring things to 3 decimal places is one way to get lots of possible outcomes you're measuring over. But it could also be something like measuring 3 different things about it, down to 1/10 a piece. If one theory puts lots of its probability within 0.002 seconds of 0.891 seconds, and another theory says 0.887 plus or minus 0.003 seconds, they've got some overlap, but measuring down to the nearest 1,000th is pretty likely to do a good job of prying them apart. Measuring down to the nearest 1/100th instead would be like adding up all the 1,000ths closest to that 1/100th to get the theory's predictions about what the measure would say as opposed to what was exactly real. And then the two theories would give around the same probability to measuring 0.89. If you were only measuring down to the 1/100th, and measuring at that precision wouldn't pry them apart much.
You could maybe pry those 2 difficult theories apart more, even with only 1/100th precision available, if you constructed your experiment to measure them somewhere different. Theory 1 might say 789 takes 0.887s plus / 0.003s, and theory 2 might say 789 is 0.891. S plus / 0.002s. But then you could also do an experiment at 107, 118, 129e, Maybe theory 1 says that's 0.567s+/0.003s, and theory 2 says it's 0.128s+/0.002s. Your 100th second resolution can detect that difference easily. It'll make one, or both theories, lose a lot of 2s in every measurement. You want to plan your experiments so they measure a place where your theories with the highest prior probabilities diverge more, so they're easier to distinguish from each other.
Good. I'm not sure how to explain what I was looking for there, or why I wasn't already satisfied with the earlier answers, but it's something like the difference between thinking in Taldane and justifying those thoughts afterwards using the language of probability versus starting to see in probability distributions and putting those thoughts into Taldane. With respect to the last point, yep, even if you can't measure precisely, you can still go looking for some other place where the major theories come apart. The thing is, that often requires more extreme conditions, or weird conditions. If you can measure time using clocks accurate to one part in 10 million billion, 16 digits in base 10, you can notice a clock ticks very slightly faster after you raise it from waist height to head height. With less accurate clocks, you'd have to find much, much more extreme, expensive conditions to start losing 10 million billion times more time from the same phenomenon, so you could measure missing seconds. Even civilization couldn't do that. The energies are too high. Still, that segues well enough into my next question. Why try to predict the timing of my next response? Why not just observe it passively and consider what it meant only after the fact?
If you were a god, you could probably learn just as much from observing it.
Perhaps. Why?
It just seems like anything you do only in your head, like making a prediction, a god could just have part of them that didn't have the answer do that. Or, more realistically, probably just do that after the fact, but not be influenced by knowing the answer. But humans are weak and flawed, and so would err if we tried that. And predicting beforehand makes us less vulnerable to that error.
I remember 3. No empirical theory can prove itself except by risking its disproof. Is part of it that if you don't make the theory before the fact of seeing the evidence, it can't have a real risk of being disproved by that evidence? Because if the evidence was already there, you knew how it would interact with the theory beforehand, and so there couldn't be a real risk involved?
More of an issue with mortals than with ideal agents, or, I suspect, gods. Or maybe it's just the lawful ones, I don't know. But an ideal agent, even a bounded ideal agent, if it considers the theory after seeing the evidence, won't be at all influenced by having seen the evidence in what predictions. It says the theory makes. So while it might not even bother to invent some wrong theory, if the evidence contradicts it, it would nonetheless be the case that if you asked it what the evidence said about that wrong theory, it would know the correct answer there. I nonetheless claim that if you hook up to the Keltham environment a random input generator that picks 3 random numbers each independently between negative 1,000 and positive 1,000, and let a god passively observe that, the god will learn less than a mortal playing the game with Keltham. Well, maybe not with the timing side channel information added, but definitely without that timing information. Furthermore, I claim that this mysterious superiority of the mortal over the god has to do with a process which includes the mortal predicting things in advance of seeing them, nor may it be done without the mortal making those predictions.
Well, say the god has several theories and isn't sure which is right. If the god doesn't get to choose the numbers, then they can't pick numbers that distinguish between their theories. You can figure things out a lot faster if you get to choose what tests you're doing. So being able to choose which tests to do is really valuable, but only if you have some underlying guess about what's going on. So you can choose tests that show if you're right. If you have no idea what's going on, then tests aren't any more valuable than the random numbers.
Yeah, that's basically it. In terms of what you should be feeling using probability sight, it's that you've got to extend out the predictions, the likelihood functions, from the things that might be true to possible observations so you can imagine what sorts of observations might distinguish between things that might be true, and then steer into that region of reality, so you get to see those observations. In terms of underlying law, there's a huge amount of math here of computer science about what determines how many observations you need, in principle, to narrow down between theories and particular classes, none of which is a practical priority for you to learn right now, because mortals are so enormously less efficient than gods, or so I expect, who in turn are enormously less efficient than ideal agents. So the principled bounds hardly matter. You're going to be buying way, way more evidence than a god would need to arrive at the same conclusion. But among the things you learn from studying those impossible ideals is that it takes much, much less evidence to figure something out when you're allowed to pick which questions to ask. It's often the difference, not so much between can be done with 10 copper and can be done with 1,000,000 gold, as can be done at all versus can't be done at all. Next, I ask, is there any wise advantage in looking at a quantity, a scalar quantity, like the amount of time I take to answer? Why the amount of time, instead of, say, my facial expression and where my eyes were moving? Not that I was letting my eyes move down the page in order, or anything that easy to catch, but still. Why focus on the amount of time I took, which collapses down to a scalar quantity, and not, say, the order in which I approached students when more than one student had their hand raised? Wouldn't the order in which I picked students be a more complicated, structured, interesting thing to try to predict? Is there any advantage to trying to measure scalar quantities, besides that they could be measured more precisely, using a pocket watch that I didn't catch anybody actually looking at?
Asking dumb question is better than asking no questions. And so he will let himself be scourged by failure? Again. Even without a pocket watch, the difference between 5 seconds and 6 seconds is noticeable. You can compare questions that received 5 second weights to those that received 6 second weights, and notice that there are gradual increases in the weight over time. I think that latter is important. You cannot notice a gradual effect changing over time in the order you approach students, without a truly tremendous number of tests, that is. You can, in the time, but I do not know how to put that into the language of probability sight.
Wrong. But positive feedback for being courageously wrong out loud, instead of quietly clutching your error to yourself and leaving me, your teacher, in a silent void of zero evidence about what any of my students could possibly be thinking. I'm also a kind of thing that requires observations to feed on in order to know things. Lots of them, even, since I'm not a god yet. There's all sorts of phenomena in the ordering that you could potentially notice right away, if you knew to look for them, and that they were there. For instance, maybe after you choose a sequence with any big number, I approach you last out of all students currently with their hand raised, and after you choose a sequence of all small numbers, I approach you first. But even if that had been true, and somehow important, like big numbers being harder for me to calculate and therefore unpleasant, and so I'd subconsciously started avoiding people in the middle of testing those hypotheses, it would have been a harder pattern to notice in the ordering data, compared to noticing how sometimes a number is big and sometimes small. Actually, even the example I gave of a pattern is really something that got projected down to a scalar quantity, on a scale of beginning to end. Where does my selection of you land inside the set of people with hands raised? If it had been anything more subtle than that, maybe like my approaching a new candidate rather than current researcher next, if you showed me any big number, then while it might be very easy to verify that was going on, in terms of updating probabilities, once you noticed anything interesting at all and came up with that hypothesis, that pattern would be a lot harder to notice initially and pre-theoretically, compared to noticing a number getting bigger or smaller. This is both a useful fact and a cautionary one. Measuring things in scalar quantities can give us results that are, in a certain sense, easier to work with, easier to try to notice things about. But that we find it easier to work with scalar quantities is a fact about us, not a fact about the things. If you're not measuring the right scalar quantity, or if the critical measurement isn't a scalar quantity at all, then you're just a Dathalani proverb. Somebody loses. A small precious object, a platinum piece, something worth their time to search for while walking outside at night. While retracing your path, it might make sense at first to go looking in any well-lighted places along which you'd walked, just in case your platinum piece happened to be there. But if you don't find it there, the first time, you need to go get a flashlight, a light-generating object, and go looking along the rest of your dark path where it isn't as convenient to look. It's a comical character, a silly child character, who insists that they'll go on searching the well-lighted areas because those are the easiest places to look. If what you need to watch is in fact my facial expression and not how long I take to answer, then you'd better not get too attached to measuring things in scalar quantities. But scalar quantities sure do make sense as a thing to quickly check out first if you have a choice of things to look at. In fact, you might find it so much easier to notice patterns there that your science mind gets out of the habit of even looking at things that aren't easily measurable scalar quantities. With that caution in mind, scalar quantities are easily related to each other. Not just that, easily related to each other by math, which makes it easier to notice all sorts of mathematical patterns in them. If you'd started recording my times more exactly, and found that my average delay times were growing over time for every student, but growing at different rates for different students, you could start looking for other scalar quantities that were growing at different rates for different students. Then, one of the scalar quantities you checked might be the number of previous inputs that student had already written down. Then, when you found that my delay time was roughly, and on average, proportional to the number of previous inputs, in a way that was similar across all the students, even as different students had different numbers of previous inputs growing over time, you'd have a critical insight into the structure of the Keltham environment's behavior. A habit of measuring all the even slightly relevant-looking things that come out in scalar quantities, or in baseline, quantifying the quantifiable observables, is something that civilization has in fact found incredibly useful. When we start messing around with spell silver, we're not going to be trying a bunch of random crap to see if anything works, even as written in the language of chemistry, where random tries are much more likely to do interesting things. We'll crush a lot of spell silver ore down to sand, and mix it all thoroughly so every batch of ore sand we use is almost exactly the same across experiments. We'll try small perturbations to the process, most of which will be harmful, but we'll quantify exactly how much less spell silver came out the other side, and compete to come up with theories that try to call those experimental results in advance. Even if most things we find make the process worse, those are still facts we can use, especially in combination with other Daithilani knowledge, to build up testable hypotheses about what's going on inside the spell silver refining process.
Am I saying the same thing as you if I say, it's good to measure lots of things, but it's especially valuable to measure things you can turn into numbers on a common scale, because those are some of the easiest for humans to notice patterns from? So when stuck, measuring your response times was likelier to be useful than noting whether you blinked or not?
Yup, well done at simplifying back into Taldane. Though, to be clear, it's even more easier for machines to notice patterns in numbers, but you won't have any number-noticing machines for probably a fair while. But all of that, this entire previous discussion, is something you could also say to an individual trying to understand, analyze, and improve spell silver refining. What distinguishes science from merely ordinary individual lawful experimentation with the goal of probing for unexpected patterns or distinguishing among hypotheses already formed is that science is a protocol for stacking the efforts of multiple individuals. The efforts, indeed, of all civilization. It's a designed artifact shadow of coordination in much the same way as governance. What, do you suppose, would be the key ingredients of science as a multi-agent practice of civilization?
They get the smartest people to organize it?
They offer rewards for correct theories and punishments for incorrect ones.
Standardization of weights, terms and measures, and requiring universal and public record keeping. Because otherwise, people could pretend to lose less 2S than they, in fact, lost by selectively reporting only the predictions they did well on.
They do it with prediction markets, because he explained those shortly before explaining this.
You need either a way for people to see and interpret the results of other people's individual experiments, like standard reporting of results, or a way to aggregate individual guesses into an overall best guess without anyone having a reason to say something other than their real best guess. If you have that, you don't need everyone reporting their experiments, just betting on reality with the knowledge their experiment gave them. Prediction markets do that, and also do another thing you need, which is a reason for people to go out and do experiments instead of staying home and making their numbers up.
Prediction markets actually don't work well enough at paying people to go out and secretly do experiments. The market traders are pretty good at guessing when somebody else is just coming in with new information. And the old traders won't sell at their previous prices. The price moves sharply enough that the experimenter often can't make much of a profit off the prediction market. Like, the current price is 80%. But that doesn't mean you can just buy 1 million shares at 80%, reveal your experimental results, and resell at 90%. Once you start buying in massive quantities like that, the price starts moving upward from 80%, because market participants have guessed you have private information. It's more straightforward and direct and less clever than that, actually. What happens is that people will just straight up promise impact purchases on discoveries they want to see made. Like most Dathalani males, I am gynosexual and very straight, meaning that I'm only attracted to women, and mostly only if they present with fairly central feminine gender tropes. Like most such men, I committed to the outstanding bounty for finding a reasonably completely safe medical enhancement intervention that would make me also be attracted to men. Because, as all the bisexuals keep telling the rest of us, we're missing out on half the fun. The collective commitment is up to something like 100 billion unskilled labor hours at this point. About 500 million gold pieces in Galarian terms. Maybe possibly. That's how rich you would be in Dathilan if you single-handedly found a safe way to turn men bisexual all by yourself with nobody else contributing. It's one of the biggest, most famous, unclaimed bounties.
What? No comment. This is a class.
Most men, if their battalion gets deployed somewhere where there aren't any hangers-on around to keep them company, like at the World Wound, find they're actually into men after all. Or, you know, able to get a blowjob and pretend it's a girl at absolute minimum. Carissa is not sure this is a valuable observation.
Is this, in fact, a problem you personally want to solve?
It's relatively less important to me now that I have otherwise saturated dating opportunities, but that doesn't mean I'm not curious. I think it would legitimately be way, way down on my list of priorities, given the current competition for my priorities list. Why?
I know some categorically adequate sex therapists who'd probably take you on out of sheer curiosity. People in Cheliacs have also encountered this problem, usually the other way. It does seem like a stupid use of your time, but who am I to discourage you on those grounds?
How do those work? Is there a spell for it? Or a magic item, for that matter? It's a less stupid use of my time if it's less time.
You drink potions and have a great deal of unusual sex that expands your horizons. I haven't undergone it. If you want details, I'll have to call on a friend. And then murder her, I guess.
Ah, wood altar. Lady Eulalia?
Yes, absolutely. Chosen of Asmodeus. If anything, Taldor's nobles are worse.
I'm going to assume that was a joke, even though I can't tell which of, like, three different possible jokes it was. Specifically, are you supposed to be too honest to just not tell your friend why you're asking? Too carefree to care about her putative discarnation? Or just signaling the lengths you're willing to go for security mindset? Not actually important. Don't answer right now. Anyways, I think my current sexual horizons are expanding fast enough, so I will table this issue for probably several months, unless somebody turns up who'd be an incredibly perfect match for me, if only I were attracted to men.
You were telling us about science, says Gregoria.
I was, and in particular about how science gets paid for by civilization collectively. Something like the long-standing quest for safe bisexuality enhancement is not likely to get completed by one person. Even the whole corporation that invents it will be building off the work of hundreds of other researchers. The commitment I made doesn't get paid out just to whatever corporation invents the treatment. It goes to one of several extremely reputable, philanthropic redistribution groups that would, if safe bisexuality enhancement got invented, pay out to purchase the impact of whoever had turned out to contribute the most to getting it done. With a genuinely massive bounty like that, there's multiple venture philanthropists who are playing a multi-decade game of funding, promising scientists to work on related investigations in exchange for a portion of their impact, and then reselling their shares of impact, of people who made discoveries that will plausibly be worth hundreds of thousands of gold pieces later, if safe bisexuality enhancement gets invented, with their work having contributed 0.1% of what got done. That infrastructure is too sophisticated for Galarian in its present state. The key point is that, like everything else in life, if you want good science, you've got to pay for it. What you're not willing to pay real money for, you shouldn't complain you didn't get, as the proverb goes out of Dathilon. What we'll do on the project instead is as follows. If you come up with a truly unique and brilliant idea for refining spell silver, and this is the part I worry may end up generating drama, emotional fraughtness. It's not a brilliant idea that I strongly expect I or anybody else would have come up with anyways. Given another 30 minutes, you get a larger share of the project. Where the issue here is that, especially once you're speaking the correct language of chemistry, there are going to be useful ideas that seem brilliant, and that, in fact, anybody else who competently thinks in chemistry language would probably also come up with given slightly more time. And we can't afford to give away 1% shares of the project every time somebody has one of those ideas. I don't have anything better to do about that than appoint myself final judge and go under truth spell on request to say that I'm being honest and impartial about it. Tap myself with the fair pricing spell, too, in case that also helps show the absence of rationalization and self-serving reasoning. In civilization, there'd be people who spend their whole adult work lives just specializing in that one form of judgment.
This is in addition to the salary and project shares already discussed?
The shares already discussed are based on your expected contribution, as expected by me at that time. It includes some amount of unique contributions, because everyone on the project is expected to make some unique contributions. But Asmodia, for example, is angling to clearly contribute more than the other Tier 1 researchers, and more than I expected at the time I made my hiring offer. If she ends up much better able than anyone else to teach law to other researchers in my place, she can, in fact, pull that off. Similarly, if one person on the project proves to be the only person in the first year able to master chemical prestidigitation and ends up spending a lot of their time tediously overseeing the refinement of thousands of pounds of spell silver, that's likewise a bigger and more unique contribution than I originally expected when I offered them 0.1% or 0.2% of the project. You can afford to give 2% to everyone like that.
She could really stand for this project to involve less openly talking about money. It's so gauche.
Going back to science. In answer to the suggestion about getting the smartest people to organize science, that follows automatically from offering huge payouts for discoveries that people are sufficiently interested in. Smart people, being smart, will go where the money is. Why would they want to be paid less per amount of effort? Even good smart people will usually go where the money is, because that's what civilization is saying it cares about. Also, to be clear, if you discover something important that nobody even thought to ask for or expect, plenty of utility buyers will show up and pay for the impact on that too. Civilization has done that many times before, because it's important to be consistent and predictable about that sort of thing. I'll be aspiring to do the same on this project, which is all that Galarian has of science, for a time. Standardization of measures. I'm not sure what it would mean for something to be a measure that wasn't standardized, but this being Galarian, I'm afraid to ask. Yes, if you measure something in Dathilan, you would report on that in the same units as everyone else in civilization uses. Otherwise, people wouldn't build on your results, and that would decrease the amount of impact you got paid for.
Surely there are also smart people who don't particularly care about money. Or maybe she's just too stupid to understand why being smart enough to do science necessarily entails also caring about money. Wait, actually, that makes sense. If science is specifically about wanting to understand the universe so you can conquer it, so if you're like Korva and you don't care about that, then you won't be any good at science in the first place. Ugh.
So I'm noticing that I'm sort of bouncing off the question of how to do science. Exactly. Because it's too large, and not really the sort of thing that gets taught to Dathalani children in a single organized lesson, we take the pieces for granted. One of those pieces is legit the part where contributors get paid for doing it, and people who make big contributions to civilization that way get paid a lot. I'll be improvising that for the project as it goes, not ignoring it, and everyone should know that. Obviously, whatever science you get will be whatever kind of science you pay contributors for and incentivize. Okay, that said, move on. Peranza suggested that science would use prediction markets. That's true, but an easy guess, because every part of civilization uses prediction markets for everything, unless there's a specific reason not to. Where exactly would science use prediction markets, Peranza?
What seems obvious is to predict which experiments would work. Alter Peranza is less terrified of being called upon by Keltham like that, of having it exposed that she was just wildly guessing based on what Keltham calls the metagame. She is able to quickly think of a plausible thing Peranzasa could have been thinking.
What does it mean for an experiment to work? You get results. The results are reality. In what sense could reality work or not work?
Well, in the most recent case, works is getting to your first no instead of all the yeses. You could have a prediction market on which tries would do that successfully.
That's a dangerous way to start thinking, one we're explicitly warned against as kids. You don't say that some results reality can give you are the experiment working and some are not working. Think of the timing measurements. Willa's and Alexandra's first observations, there didn't get them no answers, but those were far from failures. That's the same mindset you'd have to break out of to solve Spellsilver refining. Experiments on Spellsilver don't have failed results, or successful results. They just have results. Every experiment tells you something truthful about reality, which is the world you are embedded in. It never lies. Maybe your instruments are broken, or don't do what you think they do, and then what reality is really telling you is not what you think you are hearing. But that's your own error. Reality itself never lies. With that said, civilization is obviously running prediction markets all of the time on what some particular experiment will say in its results, or what a hypothetical future experiment will say. Prediction markets are a fundamental part of doing community experimentation, because prediction markets are a fundamental part of collective epistemology. The way that a civilization can be said to believe anything apart from the beliefs of the individual people in it. For example, what would it mean to say that an experiment had a surprising result if there's no prediction market assigning that result a low probability? Maybe it surprised you personally, but then maybe you were just being stupid and not seeing what others would consider obvious. Why should civilization care if just you personally were surprised? Why should an impact buyer believe you if you claim the results would have been a surprise to society? Or let's say that you make what seems to you like a really incredible discovery, a way to refine 10 pounds of Spellsilver ore into 20 pounds of Spellsilver. Call the newspapers. The newspapers are somewhat skeptical about this incredible claim. If there's a prediction market, they can check that prediction market to see what civilization thinks will be the result of duplicating your experimental procedure. If there's no prediction market, the newspaper just has no idea what to believe and it sounds weird. Or so I imagine, and so your possibly incredible discovery drops into the void. Or maybe I'm too optimistic about how it works in Galerion, and instead the newspapers print excited stories about your Spellsilver discovery, which any real Spellsilver scientist knows has to almost be certainly false. But intelligence 10 people read the newspapers, and now they think that's how Spellsilver mining totally works, and they're confused about why nobody else is adopting this great idea. Actually, that's still too optimistic. Actually, they'd just stop believing things they read in newspapers, including the things that experts actually did believe. Or maybe that's too optimistic, and... anyways, Galerion having no prediction markets is perhaps alone an already sufficient explanation of why Galerion has no science, and is so far below Dathilan's level of knowledge. Nobody knows now at which point in history science was invented. At what point pre-civilization really started learning collectively, rather than as a set of individual experimenters working in isolation or small groups or factions. But I would expect that it only happened after the simpler idea of prediction markets got invented first. You have to be able to say what civilization believes before you can observe or measure how fast civilization is learning or figure out how to make it learn faster.
Checking with Asmodia. In alter celiacs, like in real celiacs, are the newspapers forbidden from publishing sensationalist nonsense?
Snap decision. In alter celiacs, it's illegal for a broadsheet to say that the church or crown affirms something they don't affirm, and that cuts down on the worst of the nonsense among relatively intelligent people. But it's not illegal to be wrong, so long as nobody gets their person or reputation injured as a result. And nothing being said is treasonous to the crown or insulting to the church. Sivar, that sound right?
They're going to have to produce broadsheets consistent with it, possibly immediately, but sounds about right in the sense that going more Dath Ilani than that would be uncharacteristic.
Oh, right. They have to be able to produce the broadsheets on demand, if Keltham insists that somebody teleport right out and get one right away, as a conspiracy check. Asmodia should have thought of that. And they have to look like Tal'Dorei broadsheets, not Chelish ones like people in celiacs already know how to produce. This sounds like a nightmare for the conspiracy, actually. Maybe broadsheets were found to produce enough misinformation and riots that they had to be allowed only to a few crown-supervised offices. It doesn't make celiacs look like Absalom, but it would explain why alter celiacs' broadsheets are relatively small and look government-produced. The alternative would be grabbing some Tal'Dorei broadsheets and rapidly retraining some crown authors to be able to produce more of the same, with most of the content ready to go and print as soon as Keltham demands it for any particular day. Ione or Meritzel, comment something that doesn't have anything to do with newspapers.
Curve Talandria has a newspaper-unrelated question ready, that she wasn't sure whether to ask. Security can prompt that one.
Oh shit, someone is listening, okay. Does that mean that political unification and a lack of factionalism are also necessary prerequisites for science?
Not sure I'm following the logic behind the question. You need a single market for predictions, or rather you'd expect to end up with as many separate science as there are separate markets. But a single worldwide market follows automatically from arbitrage. If one market is buying a proposition at 80% and one market is selling at 60%, you can buy in the 60% market and sell in the 80% market and make a guaranteed profit and do that until the prices equalize.
Why did people tell her to ask it if it was a dumb question? Well, I guess I was thinking that if different countries are doing their science secretly, then that's sort of like what you were contrasting it with, the experimentation of a small group or a faction. And I was wondering whether a worldwide effort was a necessary part of the concept. I guess you might not need political unification for a worldwide effort like that, at least on some things, but I don't think it happens automatically. The markets would have to know about each other, both in terms of not being secret and in terms of having the ability to reliably trade information even about things that aren't secret.
Oh, sure. There's all kinds of secret research in civilization. Startups working on something proprietary, probably some stuff governance does that would be socially info-hazardous, like scalable weapons research, and, one assumes, almost everything to do with the Keepers. That's just like mini-science, where you pretend to be your own little civilization. Obviously, if you could have one big civilization under the law of coordination, you could also have several smaller ones being governed by the same rules. The only difference I can see is that any smaller mini-science, like that would be shoulder-standing the bigger science project of the rest of civilization, of which it's part.
Relayed to Corva. We needed a question for Keltham that wasn't about newspapers while we tried to figure out how broadsheets worked in alter celiacs. Your sacrifice and obedience is acknowledged.
Oh, that makes sense. She is glad to have been of service to the project and surprised and grateful for the context. She's going to nod and shut up now.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai.
Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 777-6059.